It's May 17th, 2016. Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. We're now on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Podbean, on Google Music. So subscribe to our podcast and give us some feedback. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. And check out all our citizen journalism over at ragingchickenpress.org. And if you like what you see, click on the support and membership tab and become a member for as little as $5 a month. So also, if you are interested in contributing to Raging Chicken Press as a writer, a videographer, a podcaster, just drop us a line, drop us an email at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com or send us a direct message on Twitter. We're at RC Press on Twitter. We began Raging Chicken Press almost 5 years ago to provide a platform for homegrown progressive citizen journalism and media activism. So if you got something to say, you just want to learn how to do this work, just drop us an email at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com and let's get started. So it's Tuesday in a presidential year, and that must mean that it's another primary day. Woo-hoo! So while the Republican contest is over and we got Donald Trump, right, today there's two key primaries in Oregon and Kentucky. These two primaries will be a significant test for the Bernie Sanders campaign to see if he can keep his narrow path to the nomination. And today's primaries come on the heels of a Nevada Democratic Party nomination convention that was filled with conflict, physical conflict in some cases, only intensifying the tensions between the Sanders and the Clinton campaign. So it got pretty crazy out there in Nevada. So we'll also take a look at the latest round of attacks on teachers in Pennsylvania. Sean's going to give us the skinny on a bill that would eliminate seniority as a consideration when laying off teachers. So, Sean, man, how are you today?
Awesome. How are you?
Hey, man, I'm headed. So I'm great today. I'm really excited, even though I've got a full plate ahead of me. It's a big day. It's a big day. It's a big day because we've got a big announcement here for the podcast. So
It's a big day. Really, really big day.
It's tremendous. It's a great day. This podcast, it's a great thing. It's great. It's tremendous. It's big. It's huge. Right? So,
we're
no.
The best, we do have greatest thing since sliced bread.
It's since sliced bread. Exactly, right? But we do have a big announcement here. We've been talking about this for the past couple of weeks, but today we will officially roll out our expanded podcast. Yes, you got it. So you guys may have heard of Steve Horn. Steve Horn, he writes over at the Smog Blog. Well, Steve Horn, you stay tuned after we finish the Out the Coop portion of today's podcast, right? We're going to keep on going. We'll have a break, and then we're going to get an interview with Steve Horn. And Steve Horn's going to be talking a little bit about the ExxonMobil probe that's being led by New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and he's going to really specifically looking at this the lawyer that was hired to kind of defend ExxonMobil here and his ties to the tobacco industry and the kind of NFL probes on concussions and Deflategate of all things. So check that out; it's going to be really cool. So make sure you stay tuned after Out the Coop. If you're subscribed to the podcast, it'll just keep on rolling. You can also go to our Podbean site and you can actually download the interview separately too as well after today. So we'd also like to welcome back Julia Scheib. She is a member of Lancaster 15 Now, and she's covering the Verizon strike. If you've been over at ragingchickenpress.org, you'll see that she just wrote a piece a couple days ago on the Verizon strike. She went out and interviewed a bunch of workers. Her latest piece is just up now on Raging Chicken Press called Verizon Workers Talk About What It's Like to Strike. That's up on Raging Chicken Press, so please go over and check that out and kind of let her know that you're kind of checking it out, that you're checking out her stuff. Her first post got like thousands and thousands of people checking it out and sharing it around. So she does some great work. So give Julia some love. All right. So Sean, other than the great news here, right, we've got this crazy scenario that Pennsylvania is now finding new ways to kind of go after teachers, going after teachers in ways that don't really seem like they're going after teachers, but it's going after teachers nonetheless. So give us a little breakdown of what's going on.
It's protecting excellent teachers.
Yeah, the bill is the Protecting Excellent Teaching Act. Is that right? Or Teachers Act? Is that what this thing is actually called?
I think so. But really, it's not protecting teachers. It's just a way to break teachers' unions. This bill would get rid of seniority as a way of and would allow school districts to lay off teachers who have been teaching for 25 or 30 years. And it's a way of attacking tenure rights. I'm sure you know a lot more about tenure than I do, since you are a professor at Kutztown University. But the way they're using this draconian, or it's really like Orwellian language, Protecting Excellent Teachers Act, it was voted in the House last June, so almost a year ago. And when the Senate did nothing for the past month and a half, one of the first actions they took from their little primary vacation, where most of these people went unopposed, we should say.
Yep.
Their primary vacation, the first thing that they did when they came back is that they voted on the House bill, 804, and they sent it back to the House, where the House has to pick it up for concurrence. Governor Wolf has vowed to veto the bill as soon as it gets to his desk. But there is one thing, a couple of the newspapers are supporting this bill, saying that Governor Wolf should sign this. One of those newspapers is Penn Live, Patriot News from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And they see it as a way as Governor Wolf not kowtowing to his big union donors and supposedly giving an olive branch or doing what's right for the state with the upcoming budget talks. I could find that to be completely bullshit.
Yeah.
Call it out what it is right now, because seniority is part of that three-legged stool that unions fought for over the past 150 years, along with the 8-hour workday and a fair day's wage. So, you know, you get rid of seniority, you're really attacking the heart of the union movement, and it's foolishness for these news organizations to come out and do this, because this isn't something that is a benefit. This is something that people fought and died for.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, what's so incredibly, I don't even know the words for it, but, you know, underhanded is a kind word for it. What's so underhanded about this bill, right? Again, you start with the name, right? You know, the Protecting Excellent Teachers Act, as the idea that it puts in people's head, the idea that seniority, right, basically protects bad teachers, right, and prevents good teachers from staying. So what this bill actually, from my understanding of, you can correct me if I'm wrong, what this basically wants to do is it wants to eliminate seniority as a consideration when they're laying off teachers. So that, you know, and even going from year to year for renewal and that kind of stuff. And they're using a teacher evaluation method that Tom Corbett put in place, right, that really doesn't even look at teaching observations, but it considers a bunch of other stuff, right, as kind of part of what determines that this is a good teacher.
Like test scores, right?
Right.
As one of them.
Exactly. So, exactly. So you're basically what you're doing is you're kind of extending this standardized testing model into teachers' evaluation, and you're basically, that's going to be determinant of whether or not these teachers get renewed.
So what you're telling me is they're using test scores for this. So in school districts like Philadelphia, where you have 10,000, 15,000 unionized teachers, they're teaching in a school district that is severely underfunded. They have textbooks that are 10, 15, 20 years outdated. Mm-hmm. They have schools without running water. They have schools without, maybe there's like holes in the ceilings, there's holes in the walls, and the elements are getting in. There's all this stuff going on in the Philadelphia school district. I think a boiler exploded earlier this year. Almost killing an SEIU member and severely injuring another one. But these two union members saved the lives of a lot of children because they actually jumped into the as about to blow up in the building, and they actually prevented it from being a catastrophe. This boiler was, I think, like 2 years away from its end of life period. So there's really a lot of outdated infrastructure. This is just some of the stuff the Philadelphia school district's dealing with, the lack of funds going into the actual classrooms and into the physical properties. And we want to have those type of things determine whether or not you should lay off teachers who have been working in that school district for 20 years. Am I getting this right? That's what it seems like.
That's right. You know, and I think that that focus on the boiler is actually a good example, because what it's drawing people's attention, this bill is drawing people's attention away from the actual working conditions, the actual learning conditions in these schools, right? The fact that the schools are falling apart, the fact that the funds have been cut so badly that, you know, there's not the proper materials in there, is distracting it from those things, right? Which again, cost money, would have to make hard choices, and then turning it over and focus solely on the teacher. So now it's all on the teacher's back again.
It's a teacher's fault.
That's right. It's a teacher's fault.
It's a teacher's fault that the boiler exploded. You know, and I really wish that people would actually try to bring it. I would love to see what these debates are like inside these editorial newsrooms, because it would just be interesting to see how this goes, how these debates come up. Because I would like to know if any of these points were even considered. This is not extending an olive branch out to the Republicans. This is gutting. This is chopping off a leg of the union movement. And as a news organization, you are coming out and you're supporting the going back on 150 years of fight and struggle just to even get a head up in the society.
Right. But I think we also should be clear about what we're talking about too, because that kind of endorsement and that kind of language is also dumbs down our political discourse. So let me tell you why. So basically everybody wants to, these people who are proposing this bill. And I think like Ryan Aumann, right, the senator from Lancaster, has been out front on this one. He's been kind of quoted all over the place, right? He's basically, you know, saying that again, it's about these teachers who are the only reason they still have a job is because they have tenure and they have seniority. So you can't get rid of them. First of all, tenure is not a guaranteed job for life, right? This is one of the big, it's a lazy determination. It's lazy to say that. What tenure, all tenure is it guarantees due process to firing. So in other words, if you want to get rid of somebody, right, because they have unpopular views, because say, for example, they think standardized testing regimes that we have are dangerous and harmful to children, right? If they think those and they speak out about those things, those teachers are protected, right? So it's not only like, you know, again, what's his name here? Is it David Broderick? He's a spokesman for PSEA. He was quoted in a recent article by the Post. He was quoted in a recent article basically saying, look, you know, the time in the classroom, the teacher's time in the classroom.
Like, do you think a teacher, a brand new teacher who's been teaching for 3 or 4 years will know how to controlled teaching situation compared to someone who's been there for 15 or 20 years? You're telling me that the person who's maybe been there for 2 or 3 years, yes, it sucks that you lost your job because of seniority, but
let me make this point because here's the thing. So it's true, the experience of being in the classroom, you learn basically how to kind of deal with students and how to kind of manage the classroom and all that kind of stuff. It's true. That does not mean that every teacher who is kind of who's, you know, up on the seniority list and has got tenure is a great teacher, right? That doesn't mean that. And if you've got a problem with those teachers, that basically the power is there from the current administration to basically, okay, you want to get rid of them. Then you start proceedings and you show that your evidence. Here's the evidence you're bringing forward. The thing is that, right, what tenure does is protects that teacher from arbitrary dismissal. Right. And what this does. So I don't even see this about kind of the experience. And I see this as a power grab, because basically what they want to do is they want to put all the power in the hands of the administrators and these testing regimes to determine like education instead of the educational professionals, the teachers themselves who've been trained in how to do this about what's best for our kids. They want to give it to these corporate entities and to the kind of, the corporate administrators at the head of these schools.
No. Yeah. It's just amazing that this is coming up. And, in college it was different, but when I was at Kutztown University, every semester towards like the third or fourth last week of the semester, you had a faculty coming in who didn't teach the class, passing out papers, asking, you know, fill out the Scantron sheets, asking you, you evaluated your professor. Mm-hmm. You evaluate your lab professor, you evaluate your professor. And I'm sure, like, I don't know if you're able to see these evaluations afterwards. And for the most part, I think we take them seriously, the students, because they have direct results. One semester, we had a lab professor who was absolutely horrible at what he was doing and pretty much like was biased, you know, giving the good-looking females. There was actually an issue that popped up, you know, good-looking students more better grades when they didn't do the less work. And the people who put 4 or 5 hours into their lab report got D's and it was marked like all in red. And there was this huge disparity happening and a bunch of students wrote about it in every single lab class that he taught. And what happened next semester, the teacher wasn't there.
Exactly.
I mean, so there are ways of doing this within the PASTI system. I think
all union contracts are like this, right? They basically go through and say, what if you have, especially in education union contracts, when you're talking about tenure in the contract, spelled out what are the conditions of employment, right? What are you supposed to do? What are you not allowed to do, right? And that is your kind of, are you fulfilling your obligations or not? That example you gave is a perfect example where the process was followed, right? The administration actually was able to show their evidence, right? And that teacher was kicked out. It's not an absolute 100% perfect system, but that's exactly it. What often happens is that you want administrators, you want to say, well, there's nothing we can do because tenure, right? And really all they're saying is like, we really don't want to do our job because it's uncomfortable for us. What we'd rather do is attack unions as a whole so that we don't even have to have this conversation. We can just say, like Donald Trump, you're fired.
Exactly.
So
it's Oh, no, go ahead.
No, no, no. I'm sorry. I didn't even expect to get so worked up about this today, but I am. I know
you know about this firsthand from being a college professor, and you were right now, what, going through a contract fight pretty much surrounding these things, right, about tenure again and about adjunct faculty again.
See, I think about it like this. Like, if people just think about their own experience getting a job, okay? So, well, the first thing you do when you get a job, right, is unless, you know, especially if you're going to be a teacher, if you're going to be, you know, a professor, whatever it's going to be, any job really, the first thing you're doing during that first few years that you're there, yes, you're trying to do a good job, right? You're trying to perform well, right? But you're also, you know, want to make sure that you're not pissing off your boss, right? I mean, you want to make sure that you're going to get rehired and you're going to stay on, right? And that's true in higher ed too as well, right? So that those first few years, you're going to show all your excitement and all this kind of stuff, but you also might be a little cautious about, you know, you don't want to push the limits too much, right? You don't want to tell, you know, assign things that are too hard for students, because then, for example, you might get bad evaluations or something like this, right? But as you're there for a long period of time, you begin to build up some like a history, right? To understand not only kind of what you're doing in the classroom, but understanding how your organization, how your school, how your university works. Right. And you know that there's times that, say, the administration is proposing to do something, right, that sounds good, right, and it's language, just like this bill, sounds good, but in practice what it does, right, it makes classes bigger, it makes things harder for students, it cuts off access for students to their faculty members, right, it overworks the faculty members so that they can't concentrate as much on what they should be concentrating on, a whole bunch of stuff like that. And you only get that kind of knowledge, right, through seniority, right? So, you know, teachers, the vast majority of teachers, right? I will never say absolutely everyone, because there's always exceptions in any industry, right? The vast majority of teachers or faculty members are involved with their jobs because they care about education and they care about what they're conveying in the classroom, right? And the thing is part of it is, if you want to defend that situation, if you want to defend the best quality education system possible, then you basically can't constantly be worried about your job. Right, you can't always have to look over your shoulder to see, is the administrator kind of, you know, going to say something bad? You know, is the administrator not going to like what I'm doing? Or God forbid, I decide to teach something that's difficult for students and they give me bad student evaluation because they didn't like the hard work. Right, that's why you have all sorts of evaluations. And what's key to me about what we see in this legislation is that this is not at all about ensuring quality higher education. Otherwise, you wouldn't have freaking boilers exploding in Philadelphia. You'd actually have students would have all the textbooks that they need, and we wouldn't be going kind
of
crazy.
It wouldn't be snowing on them inside the classrooms.
It wouldn't be snowing in the classroom like in Reading, right?
Right. You know, there wouldn't be. I mean, let's be honest here. This is the wrong problem. Okay, the problem here is the underfunding of public education. A bunch of Democrats came out and said that. This is a solution. This is a problem. This will only make it worse. And
so
really,
did we get any Democrats voting for this bill?
Not in the House. Well, in the House, conveniently, back in June, mm-hmm. the pro-charter representatives, Margaret Davidson and Wheatley and a couple of other ones, were mysteriously not there for the vote. They did not vote that day. On that bill, I guess they didn't want to take that vote into the primary record. They have historically supported charter schools in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh Senate. There were no Democrats supported it, and there were a couple of moderate, sane Republicans voting against it. And from Bucks County was one of them. And I think Pat Vance from Cumberland County, who she is now retiring, was the other one who voted against it.
Well, at least we got some of that. Well, it's good to hear at least that the Democrats didn't kind of do what they usually do, kind of say, well, you know, that sounds good. Maybe we should do this, despite whatever Penlog might want to sell them. Crazy. Crazy, crazy. Well, listen, we're just coming up to a break right now. Went a little long in the first segment, but sorry, I got so like, this gets under my skin, I'll tell you. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little about today's primaries out in Kentucky and Oregon, see what else comes up. We'll be right back after this. This is Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court handed down their decision in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. In the unanimous decision, the court declared that racial segregation in public education was illegal. The case was filed for Linda Brown, a student who had been denied enrollment in her local elementary school because she was black. The court's decision overturned the concept of separate but equal. This legal basis for discrimination and segregation had been established by the Supreme Court earlier in their 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. The Brown decision overturned nearly six decades of legally sanctioned racism. The American Federation of Teachers filed an amicus brief, or friend of the court brief, in support of the Brown family. The union's motion stated, quote, "The American Federation of Teachers, whose 60,000 classroom teacher members represent the group which does the actual work of teaching the nation's children, is committed to a practice of complete equality between teachers and children of every race. This principle is written indelibly in its constitution and bylaws." In addition, the United Federation of Teachers of New York City also filed a brief with the court in support of Brown. Even after the court's decision, school desegregation did not come easy. Mobs of angry white Southerners showed up at schools to protest the admission of black students. In 1957, the National Guard had to protect nine black students attempting to enroll in school in Little Rock, Arkansas. The United Teachers Union led the American Federation of Teachers to expel Southern Union locals that refused to abide by the desegregation decision. The Brown decision helped to launch the civil rights movement. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm sitting here once again with Sean Kitchen. Sean, say something's going on over there in the McGinty campaign. What's up?
Yes, it seems like there's been some reshuffling campaign over the past week since we last spoke last Tuesday. Her campaign director, Mike, and close confidant, Mike Mikus, by someone from Emily's list. Mikus is staying within the campaign, and it's going to be interesting seeing where that goes. A little bit more on that in a couple seconds. But also, it seems like Senate Campaign Committee is dumping dump trucks full of money into this race. Mm-hmm. They've pledged at least $8.2 million in to vote for McGinty, which, hey, if she's competent, she might be our next senator. So as long as she's competent, but, you know, she has to be that first. One of the reasons why I look at this thing that's important with Mike Mikus is that he, person, I don't agree with what he does. So I don't agree with his philosophy, but he's one of these cold-blooded campaign people that you get to run into every so often. Back in like 2011, 2012, he was responsible for running this campaign for Rick Fitzgerald from Allegheny County. He's now a county commissioner, and Fitzgerald was the only county commissioner from the Allegheny area that supported putting a fracking wells on in Pittsburgh International Airport pipeline and natural gas wells under important lakes and waterways in the area. And as we've mentioned in the past, Mike Mikus is also the a grassroots AstroTurf campaign called EIS Solutions, where he would create AstroTurf support for natural gas drilling in Western Pennsylvania and in the Johnstown area.
So what do you just kind of out of your gut in this one? What do you think this suggests about what's going on in the campaign?
I don't know. I think this is really coming from the Senate Democratic Committee. Mm-hmm. This is coming from Schumer and Reid, that they're really pulling the stops and they want this win badly. Emily's list is heavily supportive of. They dumped a lot of money into her campaign for the primary win, and now they're installing a Emily's List, one of the like campaign directors from Emily's List, to run Katie McGinty's. And really, in a year with Donald Trump running for president, having someone from Emily's List running a campaign for a woman senator, a potential woman senator to be, is frankly not a bad idea, considering all the misogynistic shit that's come out of Trump's mouth over the past few months.
Yeah, well, actually,
like 20 years.
Yeah, no, I would. Well, yeah, exactly. It's like, well, I'm encouraged that you see the Democratic National Committee and Emily's List is not taking this Pennsylvania fight for granted by dumping that kind of money into this. I mean, like, you know, I know that, you know, we've been, you know, critical of McGuinty's stance, particularly when it comes to her cozy relationship with natural gas and all that kind of stuff. But when you're thinking kind of big picture politics too, you're also talking about, you know, just the numbers of senators in, you know, in the Senate, right? You're talking about how many Democratic senators you have in the Senate, and that's going to determine whether or not, right, the next president, which, you know, at this point looks like, you know, Hillary's going to get the Democratic nod. So if Hillary gets it, that if you want to make sure that she's going to be able to get the opportunity to appoint Supreme Court justices, that the Democratic Senate has got to be in place, right? Because I frankly do not trust the Democratic Senate committee, right, or Democratic senators for that matter, to actually play hardball in the way that Republican senators have played hardball with Obama.
And one of the things that it's been really interesting, it seems that it's definitely becoming a point where, you know, with this Emily's List person coming in, you've seen a lot of the Hillary Clinton campaign, a super PAC, and now a couple of other senators running in states around the country have released devastating ads with Donald Trump speaking his mind on women. So it's going to be really interesting seeing the campaign ads that come out in Pennsylvania. Will this drive more men to vote for Clinton, or will this drive more men to vote for Trump? One of the things that's going to be really interesting that should be hit really hard on is Pat Toomey's hypocrisy with the Supreme Court justices. Last week, he tried to rush his federal court nominations through the Senate, and he was called out asking if he would vote for all, including Merrick Garland. He doesn't want to do that. So.
Well, crazy. We'll see what this how this plays out. I think, you know, the Pennsylvania fight, it promises to be a good one at this point, especially when you're looking at the, you know, the national polling where they're looking at, you know, head-to-head matchups with Hillary and Trump. The Hillary and Trump matchup in Pennsylvania right now, it's pretty close, right? That it's, you know, there's some polls that show that Trump may even take Pennsylvania. I mean, we're way early in the process, and there's all sorts of problems with those polls. But to see that you got some folks in the Democratic Party, they're actually going to step up and get behind McGuinty to make sure that the seat goes Democratic is encouraging at the very least. So let me ask you this then. So given what I'm going to shift a little bit on you here. But so given that we've got these primaries today, that we've got a primary in Oregon, we've got a primary in Kentucky, and the latest poll in Kentucky, that was was done way back in March. And there's been the Clinton campaign has had some fumbles in Kentucky, particularly when it comes to coal. Her saying she's going to shut down coal plants and things like this has pissed off a bunch of people. So we don't know what it is. She was up by 5 points in Kentucky back in March. Where that is today, we're not sure. She, after saying she wasn't going to run ads, now they're back in and they're kind of putting a bunch of big media buy in Kentucky to try to win this. In Oregon, Clinton is up in Oregon too as well. And originally that it seemed like this was going to be a state that was going to be favorable to Bernie Sanders' campaign, except there's some peculiar voting things that are going on up there. So when you're looking at, you know, the race overall today, do you think today really is, you know, make or break for Bernie Sanders?
I'm not sure. I think Sanders has already, you know, signs from the Sanders campaign has shown that he is pushing for the platform now instead of the party nomination. Frankly, believe that Sanders' campaign for president is over. Now it's more of the getting the platform and him sticking around to make sure some of his policies get implemented with Clinton and maybe pushing for a progressive running mate that can bring in people to the left. Most definitely. It's been really interesting. I think the past couple of weeks we've seen Joe Biden out here floating Elizabeth Warren's name for a VP pick. Yep. He's not out there. You know, this isn't because Clinton's going to get indicted, which some people believe. He's doing this just to float that name out there to get the buzz going of having a Clinton-Warren matchup. And Warren has made the playbook on how to attack Donald Trump without taking his crap, you know, and doing it in such a way on Twitter that no one has seen before.
Yeah, right.
But it'll be interesting to see what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks.
Warren has clearly brought the heat when it comes to Twitter. It's been pretty amazing.
And I frankly worked there today, patron. I'm thinking he was Republican. I was asking me, do I know who so-and-so was? He was complaining about this, that, and the other. So he asked me who should Hillary Clinton's VP pick be, and he said a Latino male or Latino female. And I think Thomas Perez from the Department of Labor would be the perfect pick for that.
So you're not thinking not the Castro, not one of the Castro brothers, but Perez?
I would like Perez. I think that would be a nice way to win over unions and Latino voters. You know, because frankly, the minorities are frankly percentage of the white population, voting population is dwindling. And, you know, they're voting for Republicans. And it's keeping that Obama tent in place, that coalition that he built. And I also think it would be nice having someone who's a lot more liberal than Clinton on the ticket. I think Warren should not take the opportunity to become vice president because she needs to stay in the Senate. She can do a lot more damage inside the Senate than as VP.
I think a figurehead. I've heard a few people say this now, and I think I'm with them on this. I think, you know what? I think Elizabeth Warren knows what's the best place for Elizabeth Warren. I think she has shown nothing but the kind of most astute political skills I've seen. If she decides to go for VP, I have confidence that there's a good reason for doing that. She stays in the Senate, I have the same confidence there. The one thing I'm thinking about today's primary is when it comes to the Bernie Sanders campaign, is that if Sanders loses both Kentucky and Oregon today, or he doesn't get the kind of 65% victory that he needs, or to kind of at least keep his path for the nomination in play, then the campaign will no longer be able to kind of talk about this narrow path. And I think that it's going to be an interesting move to see what happens and how the campaign is going to shift and start talking to its own supporters. Because, you know, it's been in the news all weekend at the Nevada convention this past weekend. It was chaos, and there were fights that were breaking out on the floor. All sorts of claims that the Clinton campaign had kind of fixed the results. The Clinton campaign saying that no, the Sanders supporters that, you know, they just didn't understand the process. I mean, a lot of this kind of back and forth. I'm concerned, like I've said before, that, you know, you've got some of the diehard kind of Sandernistas that are just going to kind of walk away from politics, forget even the vote per se, right? But politics, right? If they start walking away from the political process, then we're going to lose a lot of the momentum from the progressive side.
I don't see that as being a problem. Because like from my experiences, like I've seen these people before, your Greens and your people who operate outside the party, they're going to walk away anyway. They always do because it's not their way. And it's this silo mentality. And a lot of these people are going to go back to their silos after that. You know, frankly, I don't care that they go back to their silos. What I care about is maybe you have that really small percentage of people who get involved in the movement and they become the organizers and carry on the movement and strengthen the Fight for 15, strengthen the Black Lives Matter movements. That's what I care about with this. You know, those people, they can go home because they were going to go home anyway because they always do. And there are these armchair revolutionaries are on both sides of this issue. You know, with Clinton and Sanders camps, those are the ones fighting. But these armchair revolutionaries who don't get involved in their community. And they're going to go back to that. And what I'm hoping is going to come out of this is the people from our friends, you know, like Brett Banatelli, you know, shout out to Brett. A couple of my other Facebook friends from the people from Occupy, that they're going to bring in more energized people to carry on the movement. And I think that's what's going to happen. And that's going to be the most important.
Well, I really hope it. What I mean in particular, and I think it's a really good point. And I think that there, just like we saw with Occupy, that there's going to be organizers coming out of this process, that there are going to be some of the people that are just going to take their toys and want to go home. I think that that's a really good point. What I start thinking about is is the Sanders campaign prepared to help support that those emerging sets of organizers and so on. So we'll see going on. I mean, I think it's just going to be interesting play up between now and up until the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. So we'll see where that goes. So we're coming up on a break, and when we come right back, we're just going to have a short little blip at the end here. We're going to close it out for the day, and then we're going to turn you over to the interview with Steve Horn on our first expanded podcast here at Out to Coop. This is Kevin Mahoney, Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back. Bye. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm here once again with Sean Kitchen. I just want to give one more plug to remember that this is the first day of our expanded podcast, as promised. Right after I get off the air with Sean, that will be coming right back at you after a break with an interview I did last week on Friday with Steve Horn. And Steve Horn is going to tell us a little bit about the ExxonMobil probe being led by New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, looking at ExxonMobil's role in the climate denial industry and the lawyer behind it. So please check that out. And, you know, do go over and check out Julia Scheib's piece on following the Verizon strike out there in Lancaster with the Lancaster 15 now. She's been doing some great work for us over there, too, as well. So shout out to Julia. And Sean, I understand that you've got a little project you're working on yourself. But I don't know if you want to kind of give a little teaser to folks here or not, but what are you working on here?
Well, next month, a few weeks from now, as I've been telling you off the air, I'm going on vacation. I'm going out to Boulder, Colorado for a couple of nights, and we're going out to Yellowstone and stuff like that. But while I'm in Boulder, I will be enjoying the wonderful craft beer industry out there. A bunch of budding and emerging breweries in that small town.
And, huge, right? I mean, they've got they're like some of the pioneers in the craft beer industry.
Oh my God, there's Oscar Blues out there. Avery, Fat Tire, or well, New Belgium are all out there. But I'm going to go to some of the smaller ones. And one of the things I'm looking to do is start a podcast, once a month podcast, looking at the craft beer scene in Pennsylvania starting in July. And I think it's going to be really good. I've been, you know, poking this idea around to some of our customers. Mm-hmm. They're definitely eager to like listen to it and help support that. They think it's a great idea. We already got a couple interviews lined up, looking at some local craft brewers, maybe some people you've never really heard of, and also looking at some of the more political or geographical stuff about it. One of my college professors wrote a paper on the and spatial distribution of breweries and around the country in this craft beer boom, and he was cited in the New York Times last year. So we got some pretty interesting things all lined up.
And that sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. And we've been kind of batting around some ideas like this for the last couple of years or so. I am so freaking psyched that you're going to kind of get this off the ground.
It's going to be once a month. It allows me to travel to some of these breweries, you know, in Pennsylvania. I would love to, like, there's, of course, you have Weyerbacher, Trogs, Victory, there's Pizza Boy, obviously, all within the Harrisburg, southeastern part of the state. In Philadelphia, there's Yards, and then there's all these other smaller ones that are emerging, the Chamonix Creek, Free Will, Forest and Maine, Tired Hands. Out in Pittsburgh, there's Brew Gentlemen, there's Fatheads, you know, in Erie, there's Voodoo, Erie Brewing. So there's stuff like popping up all around the state, and I'm really like doing this to like look at that and also look at some of the other issues inside the beer industry, what it's like being a female inside a male-dominated industry like this. Is there space for women brewers? So, yeah, we got all this stuff planned out, lined up, and it's going to be an awesome experience.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And I'll tell you, if you are subscribed to this podcast, you subscribe to Out to Coop, subscribe to Rage Chicken Radio, you will automatically get this in your feed. You don't need to do anything else. I know that Sean is going to be kind of building it out so that you're able to access this in multiple platforms in the future. You know, it's funny, you just mentioned Fatheads. You know, I had this past week at the I had the first ever Fatheads IPA, which is just out of this world. It was fantastic.
And they just started distributing in Philadelphia, right, if I'm right?
Yeah, that's what I understand. And there was Spinnerstown Inn, which is out kind of past Quakertown, and they have a great kind of craft beer setup on tap, and they had this one fresh. It was absolutely fantastic. So as kind of looking ahead towards this podcast and so on, so maybe you can give us a little bit of a teaser by maybe recommending a PA-based craft beer that you think is especially good right now that people should go out and try.
Well, since I'm extremely biased towards Pizza Boy because I work at Al's in Hampton, I would say Pizza Boy's Eternal Sunshine. Either it's a sour ale, it's really nice, easy drinking. It's a golden sour, it's dry hopped. It's like 5% alcohol. I kicked the keg last night while I was at the bar. I had the last four beers in that keg, and I saw it was on tap. And that, or the one that zested with grapefruit. It's literally like drinking a sour grapefruit soda.
Nice. Well, and I personally vouch for that too as well. Is that Sean was good enough to kind of grab me a couple of bottles of that at one point. I'll tell you, it's absolutely fantastic. So, shout out to Pizza Boy and all the Eternal Sunshine fans.
It's always sunny in our lives.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, this is about going to do it for today's edition of the Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. I want to thank Sean again, once again, for joining us and kind of being, you know, part of this endeavor to really expand the reach of progressive activist media here in Pennsylvania and beyond. So thanks again, Sean.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to next week.
All right, man. We'll talk to you then. We are out.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Hi, this is Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. In just 5 short years, we've helped bring unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. I started Raging Chicken in the wake of assaults on working people, women, and all things public following sweeping right-wing electoral victories in 2010. Since then, we've done our best to hold those in power accountable and refuse to pull punches. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. Our goal now is to make Raging Chicken Press sustainable. That means raising enough money to actually pay our contributors and grow our operations. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So I'm asking you to take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, you can help keep us going and support homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. For the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee once a month, you can make a huge difference. Go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on the support and membership tab to become a member, leave a one-time donation, or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaires to fund our operations. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio. We are excited today to be launching a new segment of our Out to Coop podcast. In addition to our regular weekly check-in with our PA Capital correspondent, Sean Kitchen, we'll be sitting down with activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and yes, some of the region's craft brewers and enthusiasts. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Steve Horn from DeSmog Blog to help kick off our expanded podcast. And for those of you who don't know Steve's work, Steve is an Indianapolis, a newly Indianapolis-based, used to be the Wisconsin. I got the Wisconsin shirt on him for today. Indianapolis-based research fellow for DeSmog Blog and a freelance investigative journalist. He previously was a reporter and researcher for the Center for Media and Democracy. In his free time, Steve is crazy enough to be a competitive runner, right? Seriously, a marathoner. His personal best, you got to say it, right? It was of 2 hours, 43 minutes, and 4 seconds. He's a graduate of University of Wisconsin-Madison, majoring in political science and legal studies. His writing has appeared in Al Jazeera America, The Guardian, Vice News, The Nation, Wisconsin Watch, Truthout, Alternet, Nouveau, Isthmus, and elsewhere. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about Steve's recent piece on ExxonMobil. I mean, Steve's been covering this for a while, but look on ExxonMobil's role in the climate denial machine and the ongoing probe into Exxon's role in the climate denial, and especially that the case, the probe that's being led by New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Steve just published his piece back on May 10th called Exxon's Lawyer and Climate Science Probe Has History Helping Big Tobacco and NFL Defend Against Health Claims. So we're going to dig right into that. So Steve, welcome, man. How are you?
Good to be here. I'm wearing a Wisconsin shirt too, so good there.
It started in Wisconsin, right? It's so true. It's so true. And I'm, you know, I'm so psyched that Steve was, if people kind of rewind history a little bit here, about back in the fall, we had Steve out at Kutztown University for a citizen media forum to talk a little bit about, how he kind of got into this work and so on. And so maybe down the road a little bit, we're going to have him back on to talk a little about the nitty gritty of that stuff. Because, you know, Steve, I'm telling you, your work, I'm a huge fan of your work, especially as I was saying, you know, right before we went live, is just, you know, you get down into the nitty gritty of this stuff in ways that you just don't see elsewhere. So, kudos to you, man.
Thank you. Again, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And it was good to be on campus in the fall, too.
Yeah, that was a blast, right? Especially just at your first thing, you look at which way do I run? That was like the first question.
That was the first question, yeah.
All decked out in your bright yellow, ready to go. I was like, you know, he's dedicated. So, all right. So before we get into your article, which really focuses on, you know, it really kind of gets into this lawyer who's headed Exxon's defense team, or at least they're hiring as part of the probe. Give us a little background just to remind folks about why Exxon is at the forefront of this and their kind of role in this kind of climate denial machine.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is a crucial background before we can even talk about the next part. And that is that since the fall, I mean, beyond before that, there it was known that Exxon had funded climate denial. But since the fall, what we've learned from investigative reports, from Inside Climate News, from the LA Times, in particular those two outlets, but and others. We actually just dropped a piece ourselves about this. Mm-hmm. It's not only what Exxon denied, you know, which is climate change exists, it's a reality, it's getting worse, but it's that Exxon actually knew the opposite from its own internal research. And that is research that was going on since the 19, you know, dating back at least the 1970s. Some have rewinded the clock even further back to industry knowledge at large. Now to the 1940s, but Exxon itself knew from the 1970s, based on its own internal research that it was proud of, that was it was pioneering at the time, really, this climate change research, that carbon dioxide could warm the planet. So Exxon was at the forefront of this research, knew about it, and then decades, especially starting in the 1990s, and in between then, so in the 1990s, it had started ramping up climate denial funding through think tanks, through you know, various media outlets, and just a concerted effort to deny the climate change, or at least sow seeds of doubt that climate change is real. But in between those decades, Exxon cut back on its funding. So it pumped funding into climate denial, cut back on its funding of climate change research. And so that is seen, that was exhibited in Inside Climate News's reporting. So that is sort of the setup where we're at today that leads into, okay, so this whole thing took place. Attorney generals became interested in it. And at the state level in New York in particular, they have a strong racketeering, sort of its own RICO, racketeering-influenced and corruption organizations. And they have the Martin Act, in which you can bring this, you know, you can prosecute a company for fraud. And they were under the Martin Act. Right now, there's an investigation to see if Exxon had basically conducted itself as a corrupt and fraudulent organization and defrauded the public.
And this is interesting too. I mean, people should know that, you know, the reason why Exxon knew way back when, right, is they were looking to develop this huge kind of natural gas reserve off Indonesia, right? I mean, off the coast of Indonesia. And so they have, you know, I mean, these oil companies, they hire and they have scientists on their board, not because they're just interested in science in some abstract sense, right? I mean, the scientists are there, one, obviously for, you know, how do you go about best drilling and all this other stuff, but also to help the corporation, right, determine what its long-term costs are, right? So that it was looking into climate change and looking at the long-term projections as you know, as an influence on its profit over the long term, right?
Correct. It was two fronts. One was, of course, for drilling. So the LA Times article, the first big one that they put out was, what did Exxon know about the Arctic? Well, one of the reasons they were looking at the Arctic was because they're interested in drilling in the Arctic. They're also interested in studying what are the impacts of carbon dioxide and melting the Arctic for potential drilling in the Arctic. So that's one. There, you know, there's other areas off the, you know, up in Alaska, in the Arctic there, et cetera, in Canada. But so there's, yes, of course, for the drilling and exploration and production aspects of it. There's also for regulatory aspects, for due diligence purposes, the company needed to know, okay, if this is going to be an issue, that is, if, how bad is this issue of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? So we need to answer that first in order to determine how we prepare ourselves as a company to comply with the potential regulations to come. What they decided was, Well, it doesn't, based on their own lobbying efforts, what they decided is, well, it doesn't really look like there's going to be much regulation. So the due diligence was done. They didn't realize climate change was real. What they decided, you know, then they lobbied to ensure there was not going to be those regulations. And then what they did after that was, of course, the denial, so that the public would decide that we don't need those regulations, or at least a large enough swath of the public. There were, you know, and buy off politicians, you know, the whole influence peddling operation.
So really what's at the heart of this case is that Exxon had, you know, they were at the cutting edge of climate science because they were looking into developing new resources, and they had the scientists that had already seen that, you know, we know that global warming is real. The scientific consensus came together in the 1970s, and they made a decision at that point to basically move forward and say, hey, let's, you know, it's not going to impact us directly, so let's plow ahead.
Correct. And so that they not only go and plow ahead, and of course that's a big part of it, it wasn't going to impact their business operations, but they also decided, well, it doesn't mean that it, you know, sometime in the future as this problem gets worse, that it won't be an issue. They realize it is an issue, and so they realize we have to sow seeds of doubt in the public mind and also make sure that politicians are friendly to this cause of denial. And so thereafter, we see what we have in place now, maybe not as bad as it used to be, but still many politicians who deny climate change. And we have, you know, a network of think tanks, a network of media outlets, a whole nexus of Exxon and fossil fuel industry funded entities that deny that, you know, at least maybe not directly deny how that climate change is real, but deny that it's, you know, not, it's sort of has evolved now to that, it, you know, there's Republicans now say, well, I'm not a scientist, or, it's, you know, maybe the denial is not as hard, but the point is that over the past two decades, Exxon, to the tune of $31 million that we've tracked, has funded various shades of denial. So that's what gets us into today and the New York Attorney General's office, which is probing not only the extent of what Exxon knew and trying to put a date on exactly when it knew it, but also what did it do? And so we have a pretty good answer on all that already based on the public record. But, you know, an attorney general has powers of subpoena to get at even more direct answers to these questions. And after that, then the Attorney General of New York, but also now this is lots of attorney generals across the country, can come forward with potential, you know, the power of a prosecution or of a trial. And so that's sort of where we're at now, is only the investigation phase, but this investigation could lead to more.
Right. Excellent. So this is a good place, because we're coming up on a break right now, and we come back to that. We got the context now, and, you know, something that you just mentioned about kind of, you know, sowing these seeds of doubt, and that kind of connection with the lawyer that Exxon basically hired is really at the focus of the piece that you just published. So we come back after the break. I want to kind of get into that a little bit, because, you know, it's not just that Exxon knew, right? But it actually had a role. And, you know, I'm looking at this case, you know, attorney generals have a direct interest in this because of New York, of course, right, is on the coast, right? And it's directly going to be impacted by any kind of sea level rise as a result of climate change. So we're going to come back right after this break. This is Raging Chicken Radio. I'm Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And I'm sitting here with Steve Horn. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio. Today, I'm sitting down with Steve Horn as we launch our expanded podcast here at Raging Chicken Radio. And we've been talking about ExxonMobil and its role in the climate denial industry, some of the history behind ExxonMobil's knowledge of climate change, kind of way back in the 1970s and 80s. Steve has just published a piece looking at the lawyer that was hired by ExxonMobil. And I just want to read his opening paragraph. And I want him to kind of unpack a little bit about, you know, why this lawyer, why it matters looking at his lawyer and some of his history and kind of what this means for, you know, this potential probe that's moving forward. So this is what Steve writes at the beginning of his piece. This Ted Wells, an attorney hired by ExxonMobil to represent that company against accusations it lied about climate risks of burning fossil fuels, also represented the tobacco industry in the lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice in 1999 under racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations, the RICO Act. The smog is found. Wells also defended the National Football League, the NFL, in the infamous Deflategate matter, as well as in litigation over the far more serious issue of concussions. All right, so that's a good setup, Steve. So, you know, here's the guy. Like, you know, why does this matter?
So, yeah, Ted Wells is known as one of the most powerful white-collar criminal attorneys in the United States. And his name has really been in the news a lot these days for most people because of what's been happening in the NFL. Not so much with the concussion issue. I don't think as many people know that he was defending the NFL in that class action lawsuit that was brought against the league by players who had suffered concussions, although I think that's a crucial piece of information, which I'll explain in a bit. But he's mostly in the news today because of his role acting on behalf of the NFL in conducting the investigation against the New England Patriots for deflating, for Tom Brady, for the quarterback of the Patriots, for deflating the football. And the reason why that's relevant for this particular piece is that it's an exhibit of a trend of Ted Wells. And it's pretty much essentially the tobacco playbook, which he actually has tobacco roots. I'll get into why that's important. But looking at the NFL matter, the whole Deflategate issue, when it's actually looked at kind of objectively, take a 10,000 feet above view, scientists have said that it's very hard to conclusively say that this football was deflated based on physics and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Ted Wells has gone ahead and still brought this lawsuit in this whole thing where now Tom Brady is suspended for 4 games, and that's all fine and good. But the whole thing that happened here was that science was actually manufactured in this case, in the investigation of something called the Wells Report, in which they hired a third-party contractor named Exponent, and it's been hotly disputed. And that just gets into that's just an example of one thing that Wells was involved in that was, you know, it's sort of anti-science advocacy, legal advocacy. And that's to get into it a little bit more depth, there's a concussion issue in which, again.
Well, this is number one. This is just incredible just to say that, you know, we know the intricate details of Deflategate, of the football garbage, while you got this concussion thing sitting on the side. You got the same guy at the center of it. And the idea that, again, I want to underscore that for people, is that this guy has a history of being connected to these organizations that manufacture science for the purpose of these kind of legal cases. And I would also encourage, please check out Steve's article on this one, because there's a link to that report directly in the Smog blog piece. So please check it out. So anyways, I interrupt you, but you're just talking about concussions.
Yeah. And so the concussions issue, again, is pretty definitive scientific proof on the fact that, you know, football, professional football, is leading to concussions. Lots of players. Who would have thought, right? And so it's become a major class action lawsuit. But one of the more telling pieces, just this will transition well into the tobacco part of this, and this is the most important part. But in that whole episode, the New York Times wrote a big investigation just a couple months ago in which they showed that the NFL was, again, manufacturing science to show that the problem wasn't as bad as it was by fudging reports and that sort of thing. And they also, they went a step beyond that. And I think this is what really upset Ted Wells and his law firm. They did not mention Ted Wells or his law firm, but what they did was said, look, the NFL has been hiring a lot of attorneys and lobbyists who had roots in the tobacco industry to work on this concussion issue. And what happened was Ted Wells' firm wrote, this is very rare, but the firm wrote a response to the New York Times investigation that the NFL published on its website. So they actually publicly responded to this New York Times investigation with a letter that was written by this law firm. Ted Wells' name is not on it, but his law firm's name is. And of course, as I just mentioned, he has been the attorney of record on this concussion issue and on Deflategate. He's very tied to the NFL and legal advocacy. So even if his name wasn't stamped onto that particular letter, Ted Walz was likely involved in some of the stuff behind the scenes, and that gets into tobacco, of course.
This is really interesting too, as well. Just the fact you have a piece like that, it tells you a couple things right off the bat, right? It tells you what they don't want us paying attention to, and they don't want us paying attention to this historical pattern, right? The playbook that you draw attention to in your piece, and the fact that he made a mistake, right? His firm made a mistake here by basically saying, "Hey, I know you didn't mention us, but we're going to jump in on this." So now we've got them in your sights, right? I mean, now you can see, okay, this seems to have touched a nerve, and it goes right back to tobacco.
Exactly. So it goes to tobacco, and of course, this explains where I got in. I got in the front door for me for this investigation was when the New York Attorney General's investigation was launched. Just days later, it was announced that Ted Walz was going to be Exxon's attorney, but didn't really say exactly who Ted Walz was, except for maybe I think the Deflategate connection, but nothing about the tobacco connection. But it didn't take too long of searching for me to see, oh, wow, this was the guy who also represented Philip Morris in this lawsuit, this RICO lawsuit at the federal level that was filed by the Department of Justice that took place between 1999 and mid-2000s. So it was almost a half decade thing where he was involved with defending Philip Morris. And so through these many entrances, you can see Ted Walz is connected to all these different issues. But on the tobacco thing in particular, why is it important? Well, in the case of tobacco, we have a lot of examples that we can actually point to because of the tobacco archives that came out as a result of settlements, the master settlement agreement that the University of California, San Francisco houses. So you can actually go to their website and look up Ted Walz's name, and you can see where, things that he was involved with for those lawsuits. So that's what my piece basically draws.
Well, yeah, and right here, right? I got a picture of it right here. This is again, you can just go right to the Smog Blogs piece that Steve wrote, and he's got a link to this stuff. And here you can actually see the files. And in this one in particular, this gets right at the center of, the strategy, right? This whole idea, and I'll read from this. And this is said basically saying, look, we're in a bad spot here with tobacco, right? The science is coming out. The doctors are basically, it's not good for your health. So his main thing here, and you quote this in the piece, but to say, doubt is our product since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. Quote, if we are successful in establishing a controversy at the public level, then there is an opportunity to put across the real facts about smoking and health. Doubt is also the limit of our product. Unfortunately, we cannot take a position directly opposing the anti-cigarette forces and say that cigarettes are a contributor to good health. No information that we have supports such claim. And that really gets at, you get to see this as a strategy that is, I mean, you swipe out cigarettes and you put in climate change there, and it's essentially the same strategy.
It's the same strategy. And the sort of the reason why that thing that you just read is so important, this was the centerpiece of the tobacco industry's doubt playbook. But you see in the Exxon documents, they are one of the ones that we unearthed from an archive in Canada. You actually see that they, in their own internal stuff, are saying there is no doubt that that carbon dioxide is causing pollution in the atmosphere. So they're saying the opposite publicly. And that is important in this case, not only because of what we're talking about just in of itself, but going forward, what did Ted Walz say when he's representing the tobacco companies? This is what's in the documents as well. And he said, and it's in my article, and that's that, yes, this was what we did in the past, but we've changed. Our culture has changed. The entire, now we're with the, we're with the scientific body. And what you see today, which is why it's so.
We're team players now.
Exactly.
We hate oil. We hate oil now.
And they are making a concerted effort. I've seen, and other people have noticed, that since the launch of the Inside Climate News investigation and since the launch of the Attorney General's investigation, now there are 17 Attorney Generals that are investigating ExxonMobil nationwide. But we've seen ExxonMobil, they've rehired a climate scientist on their staff. They're talking more about alternative energy. And you can see a concerted effort where you can kind of see where it's going. You can learn from the past of these tobacco documents to see this is very likely the same exact thing that Ted Walz is going to try to argue to water down in the potential crimes that ExxonMobil is charged with. And so we're still very, very early in the investigation, but
absolutely. But I think, to bring this home to kind of why this matters so much, right, is that and why the monetary aspect of this is absolutely critical is, like I already mentioned, look, New York is on the coast. A lot of kind of the biggest cities in this country and around the world. I mean, you're talking about whole countries that could potentially go under, not just cities, right? But, you know, the way that I think most people experience like climate change, you're thinking about, okay, here's this challenge that's right in front of us. Like, so for example, this just came out of Think Progress's Climate Progress blog. When you're talking about next month, right, Bay Area voters are going to decide whether or not they're going to pay to adapt to sea level rise, right? So that, you know, they see on the horizon that San Francisco is going to be, the whole Bay Area is going to be negatively impacted by climate change to the point where portions of that city are going to go underwater, right, of that whole area. So now we've got, you know, an issue that's going to go before the borders. Like, do we, are the voters, do we raise taxes in order to build seawalls and all this intense infrastructure, right? That is essentially a subsidy for ExxonMobil and these other companies that basically knowingly, right, contributed to greenhouse gas emissions and the and climate change. So, you know, the question is that should the perpetrator, right, should the criminal be the one who pays, right, or are we going to pay? Because in this case, it's not like we have a choice, right? It's not like we have, say, okay, they don't pay, then all is fine and good. They just get off scot-free. No, 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 no. We're going to be paying the consequences through mass migration, through dislocation, and having to go under you know, have these massive infrastructure projects simply to have our cities and our countries and nations across the world survive.
Right, and so it's telling that you know, one of the states that's involved in this investigation, one of the most vocal ones, is the Virgin Islands, because this is an island state that, of course, is at the center of some, it could be of some of the worst consequences of climate change. So that's telling, but also, yeah, at the center of this whole thing is the question of liability and who, you know, who will pay the cost. Will it be the one who created the havoc that we will see in the future and the one that sowed seeds of doubt, or will it be us? Will it be, you know, the people of the United States? And so that is definitely at the center of what's going on. And I'll just foreshadow a future piece that will come out soon on DSMOG. Several law firms, this goes beyond Todd Wells now, but several big corporate law firms have put out what are called client alerts. And in those client alerts, one of them actually says, on behalf of its clients, it says, one of the things that you should be doing, talking to corporations, one of the things that you should be preparing for is potentially passing the buck to insurance companies on the cost of complying with these investigations. So they're already looking at how can we not even pay the legal costs. So it's not only about the liability costs, it's actually just the simple legal costs of the investigation. They're trying to pass the buck to insurance companies. And so it's a strategy at large where you already see it a little bit in motion with these law firms. And so,
oh my God,
foreshadowing.
So, well, yeah, I'll tell you, we'll be looking for that. And I encourage everybody to keep on looking out for Steve's pieces on this stuff and read the Smog blog and please check out all the reporting, because really they've been at the cutting edge of a lot of this investigative work. And you've already mentioned several other news outlets, right? Several other kind of really investigative sites have been integral in getting this information out. But you know what, just want to kind of touch base to that last part there before we take a break and saying, you know, we really, it seems we're faced with, you know, the economic crisis of 2008, except now we're talking about the planet and climate, right? The same issue. We know who crashed the economy. We know what happened there and who bailed out who, right? Those responsible did not pay, right? And now we're faced with a climate crisis, which really the same question is on the table. Are we going to learn from that history? Are we going to hold the people who caused the problem accountable? Or, right, are we going to let another round of these corporations go scot-free, the most profitable corporations in the world, why we foot the bill? That's really the question on the table. We're going to come right back. We're going to get Steve's closing comments. I might even ask him a little bit about the election, because I understand he's getting a little annoyed with some people on Facebook. But we'll be right back. This is Raging Chicken Radio. This is Kevin Mahoney. Let's talk to you in a sec. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio. We're sitting here with Steve Horn, and again, check out Steve's piece. It's over on the Smog blog. He's kind of that whole investigation into Exxon knowing about climate change and then funding the denial industry. And then his latest piece looking at the lawyer who's really at the forefront of defending Exxon and this and some of the history and connections with the tobacco industry, NFL, and the manufacture of science. So please do check that out. We'll have links in the show notes for this. And so please check it out. So, Steve, as kind of a way to close out today, you know, looking at a lot of the discussions about the election coming the fall, especially the presidential elections, because we're just freaking batshit crazy for like the presidential election. Like we can't pay attention to anything else that's down the street from us, but somehow we get to the presidential election and then suddenly people are going crazy about it. But, you know, a lot of the debates are, you know, about, you know, Hillary or Bernie, especially on, you know, the progressive or the left side of things. And we've got the Trumpster on the other side. But, you know, there's a lot of people talking about being a single issue voter. We saw this on the Republican side too, with Ted Cruz saying, if no other reason other than the Supreme Court. We see that also now on the Hillary side, you know, like in the Bernie side, the Supreme Court, you know, that as the single issue to vote. But, you know, I keep on coming back to the fact is, okay, yeah, I get why the Supreme Court is absolutely critical and some of these other issues are critical. But, you know, climate, I mean, this is huge, right? And from where I sit, there has not been enough discussion of that so far in the campaign. But so I'm thinking if you can give us just an angle in and your perspective and read on, you know, looking at through the lens of climate, if that was our single issue in here, I mean, how's this election play itself out? Or, you know, what's the lay of the land? Do we see any possibility that we can start scaling some of this rapid climate change back? Or are we just screwed no matter which way we go?
Well, that's, so first of all, I'll start with the Republican Party just because it's the easiest answer. And that is just today, Donald Trump announced his first energy advisor will be. And it's actually a congressman from North Dakota, Kevin Cramer, who is a climate change denier, who is very friendly, North Dakota being the Bakken Shale, very friendly with the fracking industry there. And so we already know which way that's going to go. He's cozying up with oil and gas interests. We see that T. Boone Pickens is now behind him and going to give him, you know, help raise super PAC money. T. Boone Pickens being a major oil and gas player in Oklahoma. We see another Oklahoman, Harold Hamm, who's a billionaire, who was the energy advisor for Romney. We see him backing Trump. So we know exactly which way Trump's campaign is.
Right.
He's not with special interests, but that's pretty silly given who's already
he's pro earthquake, right?
So we know the answer is pretty simple on the Republican, but the answer is a little more complex on the Democratic side of the aisle because we still have a primary that's ongoing. I would argue that it's not much left. I think that it's pretty clear that Hillary is going to walk away the winner, just because the math is on her side with the delegates. And so we're looking at a race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And so it becomes, if you're a single issue voter, both candidates are pretty bad on this issue. Hillary Clinton, of course, people that are fundraising for her bundlers are also oil and gas people. It's probably not going to end up being to the extent of Trump.
You yourself have exposed a bunch of this. I mean, you've written extensively about like Hillary Clinton's connection to the oil and gas industry going back years. I mean, this is not just this campaign season, but this
correct. Is we look at the fund. We look at the Clinton Foundation, which has been sort of off the table in the primary. Bernie hasn't brought it up, but the Clinton Foundation has maintained ties. We look at this, her State Department, and that had a global shale gas initiative. They helped privatize Mexico's oil and gas industry, et cetera, et cetera. So there's definitely a clear track record of Hillary Clinton is also friendly to the oil and gas industry. But so then it becomes really an issue of, either you back the Green Party and Jill Stein, which I'll be honest, it's I vote third party and that's fine. But if you're a single issue voter, still most likely it's probably Hillary Clinton by a little bit, only because she's not a climate change denier and she's more susceptible to pressure than someone like Donald Trump will ever be to the environmental base. It's a base that she needs to win elections, and so that's a key. And I'll say that, you know, the whole thing with the Green Party, right, as of right now, they are not running a race that is going to secure a huge amount of the vote. They have the same exact woman running as 2012, right, which I'm pretty angry about for other reasons. I just think they should have chosen someone else to garner more public support and more interest in the Green Party. So they have their own issues. So the bottom line is it's going to, in the mainstream world of voting, it's going to be a race between Hillary Clinton and Trump. Then becomes an issue, really, honestly, just an issue of lesser evilism, because both are pretty not up to par with the scope of the issue on climate change, unfortunately. But I would say that Hillary Clinton is more susceptible to grassroots pressure.
The pressure, right? I think it really that's critical. And we talked a little bit about this on the break when, Sam Cedar has been talking about this in the Majority Report quite a bit, and is talking about how, the real question is what kind of scenario is going to be best for social movements, right? And the fact is, if you got a Democrat in the White House, right, and she has enough coattails to actually turn the Senate, right, that's a better ground to push things forward. That doesn't mean she's progressive, right? It means exactly what you said, right? It means that she's more susceptible to pressure because the Democratic Party at least gives lip service, right, to those issues that are important to their base, right? And especially climate is, again, the forefront of it. So really, I think the challenges for progressives, for activists, for people who care about these issues right now, is to not do what they did back in 2008.
Correct.
Back is do not just go back home. It's like the day after the election is the day to start the pressure campaigns.
Right? Exactly.
We've already seen what Bernie has done to the Hillary Clinton campaign already, because there's no way she was talking about income inequality. There was no way she was kind of just last, a couple days ago, right, talking about extending out the Medicare, right, the buy-in to Medicare. No way she was going there had it not been for Bernie Sanders, right? And now it's up to us, I think, to actually kind of, to basically just keep the pressure on and not go home this time around. And, frankly, because, look, we're running out of time. When it comes to the issues of climate, we're running out of time. And I think that we got to have that front and center. So,
yeah. And I think the last thing I'll say is that the most interesting thing about the Bernie Sanders campaign and potential movement that comes out of it is that it's a lot of people who were not necessarily very involved in politics to the extent that they are now today. And I think that I'm a little concerned that people will be disenchanted if he does not end up running and will just go home and say, "Well, I'm just not going to vote." But not only not vote, I'm concerned that they're not going to be involved in democracy after that. They're not going to be active in their communities. And so I think that people have to see, well, look at, we really elevated this guy who people thought had no chance. We really elevated this guy to a viable contender as a president. Look at the power we have. I think people need to realize that power and start building movements off of in community by community where he's been running for office. I think that's what's going to be key going forward, is what does this Bernie Sanders campaign, the people who are involved in the campaign, where do they go from here, and how does it evolve into social movements?
I agree. And there was a piece in Bloomberg not too long ago, was an interview with some of the Occupy Wall Street activists, some of the really kind of hardened activists who've been staying with the issue of income inequality, have been organizing ever since Occupy Wall Street. As much as the mainstream media would like us to say that everyone from Occupy went away, these are, folks who have continued to organize. And what I love, the way that, I can't remember the woman's name who was interviewed as kind of one of these kind of leading activists, was saying, like, look, Bernie's one of us, right? We're not following Bernie, right? Bernie is kind of one of us where to move forward. And her point was kind of like our movement is separate from that. That is kind of like a blip in the presidential election, right? Our timeline is different. Our timeline is the daily organizing on the ground. And we're not going to be interrupted just because there's a presidential election, right? And if anything, her argument was that this is an opportunity to kind of energize even more activists to kind of move it forward. And I'm with you, man. I hope people just really are up for the challenge and are not going to go away, because we need folks on the ground.
Absolutely.
So, Steve, man, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always great talking to you. We're going to have you back on again, too, as well, some more of this stuff comes out, because, like I said, your work is fantastic. Please go check him out on the Smog Blog. We'll have links in the show notes. Not just Steve's work, but read everything over there on the Smog Blog and some of the kind of other outlets that he's mentioned today. Again, we'll get some links in there because we all need to get up to speed on this and get ready to go to battle in the fall. All right. So this is Raging Chicken Radio. Steve, take it easy, man. Talk to you soon.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're out.